Jeff Ritzman, here we are. Another day, another Paratopia.
You don't sound very enthused.
No, I'm more than enthused. It's just that I'm a little bit tired because I was laughing my ass off at a story you told me earlier. Oh, now I'm exhausted, but I'm hoping you'll share it with the world. That way we can all laugh at your pain. I mean, not at your pain. You know what I mean.
Is that really what you want?
Not really. But everyone will laugh. And won't you be bringing merriment to the world?
Very well.
Buckle up, everybody.
I like to preemptively put a footnote on this story. And that if one looks on the internet for a little known theory that inanimate objects are actually alive and conspiring against us, you'll think this a foolish thought when you read it. My story will inform you differently. I assure you. Well, I got to work yesterday, and I went to leave at around 7 and got to the gas station and realized I didn't have my wallet. So I thought to myself, well, it must be back at work. And so I went back to work, and in fact, it was not there. At any rate, I made it home, and I'm not sure exactly how I forgot, and this is the part Jeremy and I can't figure out. I'm guessing that when I got home, the warden probably started talking about something the minute I walked in the door. And what?
The warden.
Right. The war department. I lost all train of thought. And so I set out about my evening duties and was out in the shop till quite late, about 2 o'clock last night. I'm working on a double neck Gibson out there, and and so this is where our story begins. I reached into my pocket to pull out a small screw I had stuck in there so as not to lose it. As I reached in, my finger touched a $5 bill, which, by the way, a lovely lady at work loaned me $10 to put gas in the car. I put $5 in so that it wouldn't be such a thing to borrow $10. I'm just not into that. So at any rate, I'm like, oh, my wallet. Wait, my wallet. I'm missing the wallet. So quickly, I say, oh, I've got to go in and check the hamper. It's probably in the pants that I had on yesterday. And on my way out, the beautiful white double-neck Gibson, in my haste, I turned off the lights a bit too early. Let's just say that. I have remote lights out there. And the headstock, as it's laying off the work table, catches me rather squarely in the left testicular region. As I described to Jeremy, there isn't a human on the earth that can spin me around as fast as a small tuning head. I'll leave the gruesome details for another time. Let's just say strike one.
If only there were three.
So I recover from that. Quite painful, I might add. And I get into the house. I rip the living room apart. I rip the clothes bin apart, looking for my wallet. It's not here. It is simply not there. So I said, well, I know I was in the warden's car. I was in my car. Let me go check those. So I go in, I grab a flashlight, and I go out to her car. Nothing there. Nothing there. I checked under the seats. Nothing there. And then I have to go in to get my keys. So I come back out. And as I'm coming back out the door, I forget that the large wrought iron bell that hangs out outside of our kitchen door, I think my mind said, just pretend like that's not there, like it's not an actual tangible object, and just walk through it.
There is no spoon, Neo.
Right. Well, let me give you a clue, folks. There is a fucking spoon. So I wrap the bell squarely in the neck and shoulder region. And then politely, in a fit of rage, ripped it completely out of the concrete wall in which it was fastened. The time is now 2:25 a.m. I open up the car, and my my driveway's on a bit of an incline. And so upon getting into the car, I'm searching my seat, the back seat, on the floor on my side. Let me check the passenger side. So I lean across, but the incline forces me to have to keep my foot against the door so as it doesn't shut on my other leg. As I lean across to look down underneath the passenger seat from the driver's seat, my knee slips. And that's right. My testicular region lands squarely and with the full force of my body, I might add, onto the gear shift knob. I laid there cringing for a moment and then got up and went back inside. Upon returning inside, I thought to myself, Now, what you listeners may not know is some years ago, I was a smoker. I've not been a smoker in 7 years now. Unfortunately, I'm still hooked on nicotine lozenges. And so I remembered the night before I had gone to the 24-hour drugstore to pick up some lozenges rather late, I believe. I had called Jeremy right before this. And I thought, no, I wouldn't have left my wallet there. I wouldn't have done that. That's not something I do. I'm very conscious of where my wallet is. I just thought, well, let me give him a call. So I call up and this is kind of how it went. Walgreens. Yes, ma'am. I was up, about a night ago, rather late to buy some nicotine. Your wallet's here. Thank you. I'd like to come get it now if that's possible. Oh, sure. I'll be here. Okay, great. So I go out. I get in the car. And I make haste up the road to the drugstore. As I get to the drugstore, this is a popular chain, as we all know, and there are two automatic doors. And little did I know, after midnight, they block one of the automatic doors. However, the door still opens. And in my haste and not paying attention to what I was doing, I walk through the open door that opened when I went past it, to find my testicular region again slammed into, that's right, shopping carts. Now, I don't have to tell you, I was a little bit surprised. And the woman said, oh, the other door. I think my words were, right, thanks. So I went inside, we exchanged pleasantries. And so, by the way, just to make a mental note, strike three. So I go in, we exchange pleasantries. Thank you for finding my – thank you so much. I really appreciate this. I don't know how this could have happened and so on and so forth. So I go outside. Now, listeners, let me tell you, in the panic that I was in to get – because keep in mind now, we're almost quarter to three. You wouldn't think one would lock one's car. And I thought, I didn't lock that door. I drive a Thunderbird, folks. We have those lift-up type bar handles. We don't have the push button like back in the old good 70s when I had my Torino Cobra. So in my haste, I thought, I don't want to really look at my wallet while I'm in the store to see if the money is still there and the credit cards and my driver's license. I thought, wait till I get outside. So I check, and it's there. And so I grab for the door handle, and as I grab for the door handle, my hands realize that door's locked, and so my fingers decide to abruptly let loose, and that hand catches me squarely in the testicular region. I punched myself right in the balls in the parking lot. Strike four. I got in the car and began my departure, thanking God no one was in the parking lot to see this spectacle. And I left, and as I pulled out, I went to turn on the radio. And as my hand moves to, you know, the radio, I don't feel my cell phone holster on my waist. And so I'm freaking out. I've lost myself. Brand new phone, right? So with one hand on the wheel, my right hand on the wheel, I reach across with my left hand in a panic to grab my waist on the opposite side to find my cell phone holster. And I guess I misjudged the angle because I caught myself with the blunt end of my hand in my testicular region. Strike five. And with that, good people, I lost my mind. I began cursing in such a fashion as the likes you've never even heard on this program, listeners. I began flailing my arms and saying things like, God damn it, can I hit myself in the balls one more time today? Can anything else possibly go wrong? And in fact, the answer to that question was yes. Because at that point, I saw a very strange colored light coming through the back window of my car. And I thought for a second as I just barely closed my eyes, please let this be an abduction. In fact, it was not. It was, in fact, a policeman. And he came up beside the window, license registration, comes back. Well, Jeffrey, the reason I pulled you over is because I saw you swerve slightly, and then as I got closer, your hands were everywhere. You were violently shaking in the car. And have you had anything to drink tonight? I said, oh, no, sir, I don't drink. no, sir, and nothing else either before you ask. Well, what was going on? I said, it's a very long story. I don't want to bore you with it. I'm very sorry. But no one was on the road, and I had a conniption. And he leaned down in the window, and he said, a knip what? And I just burst out laughing. with that, he said, okay, get out of the car. and then I proceeded to tell him the entire story. And when I got done, he was wiping tears from his eyes. His radio went off, 975. Hold on a minute. I'll be right there. Go ahead. Finish up. So, said he'd had a hell of a night, and I brightened his whole week. And I said, well, I'm glad that my injuries could be of amusement to you. And hopefully to all the listeners. When I got home, I sat in the living room for just a second, took a deep breath, and I just let all the anger go. Got dressed for bed. Had my nice socks my mom got me for Christmas this past year, which are rather plush. As I ascended the staircase, in my underwear and socks. Remember I said those socks were plush? My right foot, the socks slipped off, sending me downward and backwards, pulling my underwear in a certain fashion that exposed a certain region, which is now the color of fire truck. I laid there for a moment, contemplating my misfortune, when I said, I realize you're all out to get me. I picked myself up and made my way into the bedroom and fell asleep.
This has been Lake Wobegon Days with Jeff Ritzman.
Oh, it's not over. Today I got up. It's a brand new day. What could go wrong, you say? Certainly no more could happen to my genital region. Oh, is that what you say? After applying, an ointment to a certain area to stop the burning, I headed to work. And as I picked out my wardrobe for today, which consisted of a Pink Floyd tour shirt and a pair of jeans, I picked up Buttonflies and I said, I like the way these things fit. I like the way they look, but I'm fiddling with these buttons is just a pain in the ass. So I chose the zip up. I would later regret that move. Because as I stood at the urinal at work, my phone went off and startled me as I zipped up. I felt a strange tingling, but not painful. It seemed to be going down my right leg, which startled me even more. What is this? I looked down at my zipper to see what appears to be a small wad of gum stuck to the outside of my zipper. In fact, it is not gum. It would be skin that I have squarely zipped up in my zipper. I think I made some kind of screaming noise and slowly made my way over to the sink to wet the afflicted area and try and push it back through, but alas, it would not budge. This required a full zip down at lightning speed, which I did. Fellas out there will know what I'm talking about when I say it wasn't my satchel. Ladies, you need know no more. I can safely say that all of the apparatus is in full working order and I've made a full recovery as of tonight, but it was a hell of a night, people, and there were no aliens involved. Just inanimate objects out to kill me. Thank you.
Wow. It all blew out of my balls.
I have nothing more.
Jeff Ritzman, nothing more need be said.
Hell of a night, I'll say. I got to bed about 5 a.m., by the way.
Uh-huh.
Great. I feel great.
That's funny, because that sounds like the opposite of great. That sounds...
You'd be correct.
Absolutely terrible.
Yeah. Pretty true, yeah.
Now, at one point, you were actually begging the aliens to help you, were you not?
I was. Yes. So if there's anything you can do... Because I give you a clue, after strike five, it was beginning to pound a bit.
You wanted intergalactic aliens to give you Tylenol.
Something. Give me an ice bag. Anything, for Christ's sake.
Well, the cop gave you an ice bag, didn't he?
Yes. That's correct.
Wow. Well, that sucks.
Nothing but fun, I might add. This is my life at certain times of the year. And they're random, and they are brutal.
Where you just become one human pratfall.
Yeah, and it's all a product. And here's the lesson for you kids. Don't freak out. Don't be in a rush. Everybody just slow down. Slow down, take a deep breath, and relax. And I guarantee you, that's what I am today. I'm better for this. At least that's what I keep telling myself.
Jeff, that might just be the best introduction to Paratopia ever.
Well, I'm sorry if it offended anyone, but Jeremy asked and I told.
And I thank you. Well, Jeff, as horrible as all of that is.
And nothing paranormal about it, I might add.
Well, we don't know that.
That's true.
Because was it normal?
Well, I don't say that I do that every day.
There you go. As I was going to say, as horrible as that is, it's even more horrible that you're nowhere to be found during tonight's interview.
That's right.
Perhaps more painful. Maybe not to you, but to the rest of us.
I'm sure not, but go ahead.
Tonight we have Mark Pilkington, author of Mirage Men, An Adventure into Paranoia, Espionage, Psychological Warfare, and UFOs. And here I'm reading from the back flap. Mark Pilkington has written for The Guardian, 48 Times, Sight and Sound, The Wire, Freeze, The Anomalist, and a host of other magazines and journals. His first book, Far Out, 101 Strange Tales from Science's Outer Edge, was published in 2007. Mark also runs Strange Attractor Press. He lives in England, right. And you can catch up with him at www.strangeattractor.co.uk. And this is an interview that I'd been wanting to have for quite some time because I really, really liked his book. And although you didn't get a chance to read it, I thought, you know, this would be something that you could really sink your teeth into nonetheless because you'd know exactly what we're talking about.
Can we not talk about sinking teeth into anything, please?
Yes. Not the teeth of one zipper, mind you.
Thanks.
In any event, he's also a crop circle maker, so I thought that that would be something that we could get into. But unfortunately, you couldn't make it because you were too busy with all of that. So,
well, let's qualify that.
As it turns out, you were busy hitting yourself in the testicles all night.
Thanks for that.
It just dawned on me that's what you were doing the whole time that we were doing this interview.
No, it was much later after that interview, actually. I was at work, actually, when the time differential between the UK and the United States was, shall we say, at play.
Yes.
And Jeremy had to go ahead so as not to keep Mark up too late. So I just told him to go ahead and do this without me, and I'll listen to it the next day. And so I'll be here for the after chat.
All right, and we'll get your thoughts on that and much, much more. Without further ado, here is Mark Pilkington. And by that, I mean two commercials, and then Mark Pilkington. There's always further ado, isn't there? I'm still a-doing. Much ado about nothing.
CyberEars.com.
Yeah, can we just do that instead?
No.
If you record audio for any purpose, chances are you want it to be heard. You want to attract the largest audience possible who can hear your message. That's where we come in. We're CyberEars.com, a revolutionary internet service that will host your audio files and help you promote and track its popularity. Considering hosting a podcast to the world? We have all the automated tools to make the process as simple and easy as it can be. No technical mumbo-jumbo to work out. CyberEars.com does all the work for you. You record it. We take care of the rest. So don't delay. Go to CyberEars.com today and register for a free trial account. Upload your audio files and get heard. With CyberEars.com, it's your audio on your terms.
Urgency is thrilling and ardently intelligent and graceful work. Mitch Horowitz, author of Occult America, The Secret History of How Mysticism
Brilliant.
Shaped Our Nation.
The ending was powerful and smack on.
Colin Andrews, internationally acclaimed author / human consciousness researcher.
Jeremy writes a mean book filled with subtle humor and flashes of deep insight into who we are and what we're really capable of.
A must read for any serious truth seeker.
Deb Cobble, author of Abducted,
completely blows everything you think is true out of the water. I urge you to get this book because it's got a lot of power. It is a deeply interesting and deeply funny book. Whitley Strieber, author of The Key in Communion.
Urgency by Jeremy Vaney. It might be the most important book you read all year.
It will be the most fascinating. In stores and paperback on the Kindle and on the Nook, now available.
Paratopia, without further ado, please welcome our very special guest, author of Mirage Men, Mr. Mark Pilkington. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Paratopia.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
And by us, I mean me. Unfortunately, Jeff can't be here, but he'll be here for the after chat. So, Mirage Men, I gotta say, I mean, I've read a ton of UFO literature over the years, and most of it is crap. But this book is not crap. This book is really great, so thank you for writing it.
And like you, I've read far too many UFO books, so I knew which kind of UFO book I wanted to write and which I didn't. So, and I wanted to write a book about UFOs that people who weren't interested in UFOs beforehand could read and understand why some of us find the subject so interesting.
Well, I love these books like yours that actually go back and look at characters out of ufology that I forget about, you know, such as Richard Doty. I mean, to me, Richard Doty, he's got some sort of mythical stature, but you don't really hear much about him by way of interaction anymore. You know, you just sort of hear these old stories, and yet you most of this book is your interaction with him and trying to make a film about him. So I found all of that fascinating, but what led you to this in the first place? You'd mentioned UFO sightings in the book, but for people who haven't read it, take us through your history with UFOs.
Yeah, well, it's a subject I've been fascinated by since I was a kid, really, and I'm sure growing up in the sort of mid-70s and early 80s, there were plenty of reasons to be fascinated. Obviously, a lot of great films, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, E.T. and all sorts. But it was also a time of general interest in the subject. And I'm sure through some kind of cultural osmosis, I must have picked that up. But then, so in the mid-80s, I think it must have been Timothy Good's Above Top Secret that I'd have read at age 13 or 14 that sort of tipped me even further in that direction, and it sort of stayed with me, really. And then, yeah, I opened the book with a genuine UFO sighting that myself and two friends had actually in Yosemite National Park on the sort of California-Nevada border. Is that right? Sorry, California-Nevada? Yes, it is. And that was a genuinely sort of still puzzling sighting of these sort of silver spheres, probably, I'd guess, 6 to 8 feet across, that one at a time kind of bobbed their way over us and certainly didn't seem to us to be balloons, but we couldn't make sense of what they might otherwise have been. And you can speculate as much as you like. But one thing I found interesting kind of looking back over that story was that people were describing similar things as far back as World War II in the sort of so-called Foo Fighter encounters. So, you know, I think they are genuine UFOs, unidentified flying objects. But my real interest really is in looking at the way that ideas about UFOs and flying saucers and flying triangles and what have you have kind of evolved over the past 60 odd years, and sort of looking, trying to make sense of some of the reasons why that might have happened and how those beliefs and ideas may actually have been nudged and kind of shaped and formed by people primarily in the military and intelligence sort of services. And that's really the focus of the book. And Rick Doty, for those who aren't familiar with him, he's really one of the few people working within the American Air Force and intelligence sort of services. He was working for Air Force Officers Special Investigations, and he's one of the few people to actually be exposed for running UFO disinformation and deception operations back in the early 1980s. And he, as you say, he'd kind of vanished from the scene after being quite active until the late 80s. And it was entirely by coincidence, really, that my friend and colleague John Lundberg and I were able to sort of track him down and ended up spending quite a lot of time with him. And wouldn't say we got to know him, because he's a complex and deep character, I think. But we certainly sort of became friendly with him and found him increasingly enigmatic and puzzling as our time went on. And I've actually not had any contact with him for over a year now, so I don't know what he's up to. But he works in the police department in a town in New Mexico.
Do you think that the government or the military or whoever is still interested in putting out disinformation stories? Do you think SERPO is one of those? Do you think they care at this point?
I don't know what SERPO was, and I think it was probably, well, I think it was certainly a concocted story, but where it came from and what its agenda or purpose was, you know, again, we've only got informed speculation. There's a fair amount or quite a lot of circumstantial evidence to suggest that our friend Rick and some of his and possibly other people were at least involved in sort of following up the story and engaging with people who are interested in it. But I don't know what Serpo is about. As to the question of whether the US or other militaries and intelligence services still make use of the UFO story, I'd say certainly. I'd say there's no doubt about that. But one sort of important point to make is that I'm not suggesting that there's a kind of ongoing program to generate UFO accounts or stories. I think the UFO is just one of many costumes or disguises that they will pull out of the dressing up box as and when it's appropriate and expedient to do so. And obviously, if the Air Force or other organizations who use aircraft, CIA or whoever, are involved and they're needing to disguise an operation or obfuscate an operation, then obviously UFOs is a good way to do that. And one of the sort of great things about the UFO lore or the UFO story is that it keeps sort of self-perpetuating and evolving of its own accord. So there's not a great deal that people who want to exploit it need to do. They just need to kind of tap in at the right time and see what's there and then sort of put that to good use. So I think, yes, they're still doing it.
Do you have any just sort of intuition on why it is that a guy like Rick Doty can still be around in this and still be taken seriously in certain circles, given all that he's admitted to?
Yes, I do. I think, to coin a now well-worn phrase, people want to believe, and I think that's the ultimate power, really, of the UFO and the lore that's kind of generated and developed around it. People really want there to be something out there. And so it's quite easy, really, to, again, to sort of tap in and exploit that desire and that need. And I think, really, I sort of conclude the book, and it's something I believe, and I'm obviously not the first person to suggest it, but the sort of UFO lore acts as a kind of secular, in most cases, secular, spiritual or religious sort of system or a complex for people, a sort of framework for making sense of the vastness of space and the complexities of life on Earth. And I think someone like Rick or any of the other people, there are many people within the pro-UFO civilian community who quite clearly just exploit might be too harsh a word, but work within this belief system and encourage people's beliefs and shape them to a certain extent. I wouldn't want to name names, but sort of any of the people you see regularly sort of talking about extraterrestrial reality and visitation and the cover-up and all these things, who they're basically doing the same thing. And I think with Rick, the real question for us and for the book is what does he actually believe, or what did he actually believe? I began to wonder if, you know, he had really experienced something or been told something by someone he trusted or seen documents or something that on some level made him believe that he wasn't actually lying, at least not all the time. But,
so you're with your interactions with him, you thought that at least there is a chance that he believed what he said on some level.
On some level and some of the time. I think some things I suspect he didn't believe. Other things I think he did, but he's very sort of very good at just sort of spinning tales, and they reached a point where, you know, these stories were just kind of flowing from him, and it becomes difficult to sort of separate one thing from another. But I think on some gut level he probably does believe. And there's a real clue comes going back to his sort of days of direct involvement with the UFO researcher and the sort of person who helped put Roswell on the map back in the late 70s, 1979, 1980, was William Moore. And there was a very interesting period when William Moore, Rick Doty, and a guy called Bob Pratt, who was a well-respected journalist working for the National Enquirer, which was one of the sort of key points for UFO, for getting UFO reports and stories out there back in the late 70s. And they actually, after the closure of Project Blue Book, they actually kind of took on the mantle of investigating and ultimately promoting UFO stories. So you had these very interesting exchanges between Rick Doty, Bob Pratt, and William Moore, and they actually planned to write a novel together, which I think was called Majestic, if I'm correct. I think it went through a couple of name changes. But in that, there was a character who was clearly modeled on Rick, though pseudonymous. And in this book, in the novel, the character that is sort of equated with Rick Doty becomes a martyr to the cause of getting the truth about alien visitation and the ongoing engagement with an extraterrestrial race out to the people. He's actually assassinated by, I think it's, I don't know who, someone from MAJIC or from the CIA. And the extraterrestrials at the end sort of take his body up onto the spacecraft and take him to their planet. So I think, you know, on some level, that says quite a lot about maybe what Rick feels and believes, or certainly what he did feel and believe back at that time anyhow.
When you take a look at something like Serpo, just when you first read it or read about it, what was your impression?
I was very interested when I first saw it. Actually, no, that's not quite true. When I first saw it, I just thought, oh, it's sort of more nonsense. And I sort of didn't... I read the first sort of disseminations and didn't look at them after that. Then a couple of weeks later, I thought, well... And I think from after talking to John Lumber, we thought, well, actually, this is probably more interesting than I'd initially thought and worth a proper look. And when it became really interesting was seeing how it reanimated and revitalized what had been a very moribund UFO scene. I mean, I think by the sort of when it appeared was what, 2004, late 2004, late 2005, I think. Sorry, should tell listeners it's quite late here, so I'm a little bit drowsy, but it really did sort of. Bring what had been a sort of dead UFO scene back to life, and people really jumped on it as something that could actually, you know, be an important piece of the huge and ever growing UFO jigsaw. And what immediately struck me was there were throughout the material that was being sent out, the reports from the sort of alleged Serpo papers describing this exchange program sending American Air Force men out to the planet Sinu or Serpo to sort of live out there for 13 years. What struck me was that there wasn't anything really in there that couldn't have been mined from the pre-existing UFO lore by someone who was familiar with the material. So it was sort of cunningly composed to knit together and weave together all the old elements for things like the Holloman landing from the early 1960s, where extraterrestrials are supposed to have made contact with the U.S. Air Force at Holloman Air Force Base. There were sort of sly references to what else was there? Oh, a really nice point I liked was that the last Serponaut, shall we call them, who returned, did so in 1978, the year after Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out. And, of course, the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind depicts basically a Serpo situation with 12 red-suited sort of pilots preparing to get onto the extraterrestrial spacecraft. And the end of Close Encounters was supposed to be a reference to the Holloman landing. So everything neatly kind of folds back in on itself in a kind of fractal fashion. So I thought it was a well pieced together document, but I did think it was put together by somebody who was quite familiar with the UFO story and the lore that existed. But to what end was it a, you know, was it just someone having doing some creative pranking or hoaxing, or was there some deeper purpose to it? I don't know. I wondered if it was some kind of attempt to see how far data kind of spread and see the ways in which UFO data spread across the internet, almost like a barium meal in a patient in a hospital, sort of a sort of mimetic tracking program of some sort, I thought was one possibility. But we still don't know.
The thing I find interesting about Serpo, really the only thing that I find just, I don't know, what, like, to what lengths do you go to hoax something? Uh-huh. I mean, there's so much information, there's so much just paperwork that, I mean, to pull that off, do you have to plan this years in advance, months in advance? Who types all of that up?
Yeah, and absolutely. And there were, you know, thousands and thousands of words. That was the length of a fairly long book. And yes, I don't know if there was someone with sort of graphomania who sat at their computer and just churned this stuff out, which is possible. Back in the late 80s, there were people like, I don't know if you ever came across people like Brandon, who operated on the bulletin boards and just churned out pages and pages of material, or O.H. Krill, who was supposed to be a was a pseudonym for somebody, possibly John Lear or someone connected to John Lear, who did just churn out vast amounts of data, but nothing quite on the scale of Serpo. So it could be that it was some kind of collective authorship thing, like, I don't know if you've seen the book Q by Luther Blissett, which is a sort of collectively authored kind of alternative history by several Italian academics and authors. There are lots of possibilities. It could be something that one person started, a bit like the, you know, crop circles. One person starts them, then they get tired, someone else picks up the baton and carries on, and it sort of just goes or continues organically in that way. But it did seem initially to be coming from the same set of IP addresses on the internet, so there was some consistency to it, and obviously the language, there was some consistency to it. So yes, I mean, somebody spent a lot of time preparing the documents, and they seem to have slowed down now, but you know, they kept coming for a 2 or 3 years at least, so that was a lot of work. Although it's interesting that as interest in the documents waned, so the number of papers that were appearing also kind of slowed down. So I think initially someone was driven by the kind of reception, that this ecstatic reception that the material got when it first appeared.
Did you have you kept in contact with any of the original proponents of Serpo?
Not really. If I was anywhere, certainly, yeah, I'd be happy to speak to people like Bill Ryan, who I liked a lot, and Victor Martinez, who I also liked. But no, I haven't had much contact since the book came out.
So do you know if they are still on board with that stuff, or do they feel they've been had?
I don't. It's a good question. There's an important book, so for anyone interested in the UFO story, called When Prophecy Failed, by sociologist, Leon Festinger, written in the late 50s, and he infiltrated a sort of suburban UFO flying saucer group, and they had this sort of their leader, who was a housewife, effectively, was channeling extraterrestrials, and they were basically preparing the group for a great flood that was going to destroy their world, and then the flying saucers would come and take them away in a sort of Jehovah's Witness style ascent to the heavens. But what Festinger found interesting was that when this obviously didn't happen, because we're still here, rather than reject the group and its teachings, people actually became more wedded to the ideas and more sort of emotionally and spiritually involved with the group. And I think we saw something like that happen. You see it happen a lot in the UFO lore, but I think we saw something like that happen with Bill Ryan, who after the Serpo story kind of after his role in that sort of ended, he set up a sort of group called Project Camelot, and they have sort of disseminated a great deal of pretty outrageous and, I would say, frankly, unbelievable sort of material generated by interviews with sort of human cyborgs and people who worked in the military-industrial complex on the UFO back engineering program.
Really, human cyborgs, or like Dr. Greer is kind of a human cyborg?
It's a alleged. Well, you'd have to read the interview for yourself. It's that was actually a great one. I can't remember the guy's name offhand, but he's up on the Project Camelot site. But he claimed he had a cyborg arm that could sort of, you know, smash its way through brick walls. And disappointingly,
awesome.
At no point did Bill Ryan, who was videoing the interview, say, well, you know, can we see you do this, please? Or could we take you to a construction site or a derelict building and see you tear it to pieces with your bare hands? But anyway, the thing with Bill is I think he had a really pretty bumpy ride, actually, to be fair. And he's a great guy. He had a bumpy ride with the whole Serpo affair, and I think it kind of upset him a little bit, and he sort of left that behind and moved on to even more crazy material, really. So I think, and Victor Martinez, I'm still subscribed to his mailing list. He's sort of occasionally puts out UFO stories, but a lot of it's now sort of astronomy and movie news and sort of photographs and things like that. So he's the Serpo thing obviously plays less of a role in both their lives, I think, now.
Of all the people in the book that you encounter, Kit Green to me seems to be the most fascinating. And interestingly, my co-host Jeff Ritzman, who's had a lot of highly strange things in his life, got a call from... Oh, and if I'm not allowed to say this, I guess he'll make me edit this out. But from Mark Allen from Above Top Secret saying, there's this doctor who has offered to, I guess he wants to sort of interview you or check you out or something after hearing about all of your strange experiences. And it turns out that doctor is Kit Green.
Wow. Okay.
So that at least tells me that he is interested in what he's talking about. To some extent. So in terms of being sort of a CIA dupe or something, he's not purely that, right? What is Kit Green? I mean, he says some pretty, balanced, credible sounding things about the way information would be, you know, he keeps a hypothetical, would be disseminated if there were a real presence here.
Yeah, Kit is a truly remarkable and impressive individual, really. You know, he's one of the more impressive people I've ever met, I would say. But he really, when John and I first went to see him and to talk to him and interviewed him in Detroit, I wasn't convinced that he wasn't stringing us along in some way or kind of checking us out for some reason of his own. But I genuinely, so now in hindsight, I believe that he genuinely does believe that there has been some kind of engagement with an extraterrestrial civilization, and that there is some kind of program to make sense of their technology. I think he does believe that to be true, and he thinks there's a kind of program to the global public. And as a sort of science analyst for the CIA back in the 70s, one of his key interests was parapsychology, and I think again he's really still fascinated by that. But he's also interested in sort of psychology and the way that perception and sort of experience sort of shape people's beliefs and their sort of sense of encounters with the unknown. And it would make total sense that he would contact your colleague to sort of talk to him about his experiences. I think he's genuinely sort of interested in these things. And don't forget, it was Kit who got the CIA involved in the remote viewing program back in the early 70s with Stanford Research Institute and Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ. So, yeah, he's as genuine as they come, and certainly I don't doubt that he's been engaged in some sort of shifty projects over the years that he worked for the agency. But he's a good man. In fact, one of the absolute sort of critical pivotal points in Mirage Men comes sort of following our meeting with him, and I realized the moment I sort of clocked, and this is actually how it happened. The moment I realized that ultimately it's a matter of belief, and he himself points out that he's an Episcopalian. He's a Christian, and yet he can be a medical man, a scientist, a CIA analyst, and a UFO believer. But ultimately he's got somewhere in his personal sort of psychological makeup, he has some what I would consider peculiar beliefs about, God and higher presences and higher beings, and that chimes perfectly with what I think is his belief in an extraterrestrial visitation. But and he understands that drive to believe, that need to believe, and I think that makes him a incredibly important person for the UFO community to have on side. But it's spoke at great length with us and talked about his ideas of a systematic desensitization of people's fears about the point at which we make contact with other civilizations. And this is going back to the early days of the UFO story, to the Robertson panel of 1952-1953, when the CIA first kind of got involved in the subject. And one of their key concerns was that, the UFO flying saucer panic, whether or not there was any actual reality attached to it, could generate very serious civil disorder and panic situations. Just a couple of years before, Quito in Ecuador had suffered incredible civil disobedience, and tanks had had to be called in to sort of quell the rioting. And 20 or so people were actually killed, all because of a broadcast of Orson Welles' radio adaptation of War of the Worlds. And they were very sensitive to the possibility that, increasing fears about invasion from outer space and these things might cause the similar scenario. So in Kit Green's kind of model, since that time, there has been this program of systematized desensitization to kind of prepare people for ultimately, as it's now called, disclosure, for revealing the truth. But I'm not convinced that this moment will ever happen, and that this moment of disclosure will ever happen, this moment of apocalypse or revelation. I think, that's part of the kind of sort of generally Christian theological makeup of much of America, in that, and that's part of the kind of core beliefs of the Christian system, that at some point this revelation will come, and that's really echoed in the sort of disclosure narrative.
These guys like Doty and Kit Green, if anyone should know something, you'd think maybe they do, and they seem to say, well, we believe that somebody does. Do they ever tell you who they think might, if they don't? I mean, who's left that should know the quote-unquote truth?
Yeah, you'd think it would be... what's interesting is these guys all half, wonder if one of them has seen something and isn't talking about it. So they obviously, they've often... I think they've put their heads down together to sort of try and piece things together between them. But it's interesting, the thing that they say, and the other guy who... And I hadn't read his book, I haven't had time to read it, but John Alexander from the Army would be another man who's had a long-term interest in the subject and ought to have been able to get close to to whatever truth there is. And he again says there is no final truth to the story, at least to the ideas of a sort of government or military cover-up. But all these people say that if if there was something, if something had come down, say, in the 40s or at any point, and if there was still an attempt to back engineer it and to make sense of it, as Philip Corso said back in the 90s, then it would have moved into private industry and into, you know, very kind of compartmentalized, privately run companies who would probably have separated out parts of the various components, and so would be working on them to try and piece together what the technology was, how it worked, and these things. So it would have moved into the industrial sort of wing of the military industrial complex, I think. And that would also help to kind of keep it secret. And I would expect, according to this sort of idea, then a lot of these groups wouldn't even know what it was they were looking at. They would just be given pieces of something and be asked to make sense of it. And from what I understand, that's the way it worked when Soviet aircraft or technology sort of came into U.S. hands sort of during the Cold War.
The UFOs that you saw, did they do anything spectacular maneuver-wise that, you know, you couldn't account for?
Nothing spectacular, but they did do something three things that were very strange that still leaves me feeling that they were, I'm convinced they were ultimately sort of earthly objects, but I don't know what they were. The three things, the first one I saw was just hovering maybe 4 foot off the ground in a sort of forest clearing, but I was in a passing car moving quite quickly, and someone I didn't know was driving, so I couldn't sort of stop them to get out and chase it. But that was just hovering, off the ground, sort of just a few feet off the ground. Then we next saw one flying over a lake towards our car, then over the car. I flew in a very straight line, very purposefully. It wasn't drifting like a balloon. It seemed to be powered in some way. And then the interesting thing was that when it hit a kind of rocky bluff, if it was a balloon, I would have imagined it would sort of hit the rocks and then sort of bounce off and then maybe drift over the top. But what it did was it kind of reached a certain distance, and this is 15 years ago now, so I couldn't say exactly what the distance was, but reached a certain sort of point away from the rocky bluff and then just sort of followed the sort of contours of the bluff and sort of as it climbed up. And then once it got to the top, just sort of went over the top and disappeared again. And then what was interesting is then another one, maybe a couple of minutes later, came down following exactly the same route and just behaved in exactly the same fashion as it came over the lake and went over this bluff. So that was, I wouldn't say spectacular, but sublime and sort of uncanny, certainly.
When you say that you think there is a terrestrial origin, when you look at like last week's news item about the I don't even know the name of the technology, but the unmanned ship that's traveling 13,000 miles an hour and they couldn't get it to work.
Yeah.
And then you look at what you saw years ago. How do you combine those and go, yeah, maybe that's ours?
Well, for one thing, these things were moving very slowly, but if they were technology, then, I'm puzzled as to how they were keeping afloat or keeping sort of up in the air. People have suggested that they were some kind of reconnaissance craft, and they may be some kind of natural phenomenon as well. They could be. I've read that if you see plasmas, so like ball lightning by a form of ball lightning by daylight, they can appear to be silvery and mercurial, and that would certainly kind of fit the description. But these things were moving at a pretty leisurely pace; they weren't speeding by any stretch of the imagination. The DARPA unmanned craft that went missing last week. 13,000 miles an hour is incredible speed that you would have trouble sort of following with the naked eye. If you look at the early accounts of sort of flying saucer and UFO sightings, they're flying at hundreds of miles an hour at most, if not less. So there's nothing very spectacular about a lot of those early accounts. And, you know, I think you'll find that the sort of the UFO as a kind of icon or as a as an idea always kind of keeps just ahead of current technological, human technological capacities. So it's always kind of just around the corner of what we're capable of. And that will always, I think, be the case. That's a part of the role of the UFO, if you like, is to kind of draw us into a technological future in which, you know, we're ultimately the pilots of these craft. But if you look at, say, the first sort of main UFO wave in the States, or the best known early one in the late 19th century, the sort of airship waves, these the sort of dirigibles, the sort of Zeppelin style craft that were being described there had already appeared in science fiction in the writing of Jules Verne most famously. And in another 10 years, about another 10 years after these sightings were happening all across the US and later in Europe, it would be another 8 to 10 years before the Zeppelins first sort of began to be produced on any scale and flown sort of successfully. So again, you have this sense of, you know, what people describe seeing is always made to be just ahead of what we know and what we can do.
Have you done any, I don't know, psych studies or sociological studies that would show why that would we would do that, why that would be important? Because, I mean, it sounds like almost a group psychological phenomena of we're projecting our future in some way. I mean, you actually did see what you saw, so there's no question that you made it up, right? You saw this, but so either it existed or it was some sort of hallucinatory projection, right? Or some combination of the two? I mean,
I kind of played with the idea of it being some kind of tulpa, which is in sort of comes from Tibetan sort of folklore and mythology, and is a kind of projected thought form taking on human or animal or some kind of form. So I wondered if it was some kind of technological tulpa.
Why would you need to do that?
I don't believe for one minute that it was, but at the time it was something I entertained, you know, as I was going through all the different possibilities. And I'd been reading John Keel books and Alexandra David Neal's Magic and Mystery in Tibet at the time. So, you know, I was reading about this stuff, but I don't believe that's the case. And there were three of us who saw it. So I think more importantly is actually you project in hindsight onto your sighting, you project kind of the impossible or sort of fantastical notions onto them. And one thing I was disappointed I wasn't able to do was what I wanted to do was actually, and I lost touch with the people I saw the craft with, but I wanted to try and contact them and get them to write, you know, write their own versions of the account and then to compare the stories sort of maybe as an appendix to the book. And I wondered if we'd have very different memories of what had happened. And as you know, I think the sort of fallibility of memory and the ability of sort of memory and fantasy and dream and these things to kind of start bleeding into each other is certainly sort of critical to a lot of the UFO lore as well. But yeah, you're right on one level. You know, either these things are happening or they're not. And I have no doubt at all that, like myself and, you know, thousands of people have had UFO experiences which can be very powerful and life-changing for them. But, you know, what their interpretation or their response or their reception of an encounter or of an event is can be very different to the actual event itself. And, you know, again, you could just need to look at people's religious experiences or people's experiences with synchronicities and coincidences, which might seem very mundane to other people, you know, can be very powerful for those who are affected. Or the classic one is crop circles, which, you know, are sort of artworks impressed into mainly wheat fields in the UK and elsewhere. But these, you know, take on great mystical, cosmological, religious sort of importance for some people. So,
well, Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But I wanted to ask, there was one incident in the book that you didn't really highlight, but it's in there. And I thought it was pretty spectacular, actually, unless it wasn't. And so you'll tell me, which is happening upon some Native Americans, and one of them produces a rain cloud before your very eyes.
Oh, yeah, that's I'm trying to remember their names. Sherman, one of them was called. And here, I'll try and find them. Humphrey and Sherman, there they are. Yeah. And this was, again, it's one of those synchronistic coincidental moments. Greg Bishop and I were in Dulce, New Mexico, we were going to be filming there, but we sort of toyed with the idea of going up onto the Archuleta Mesa there, where sort of the UFO lore would have it. There's an underground base, but actually, it's Hickorilla Apache Indian territory, and they're very unhappy about sort of UFO buffs clambering around on the mesa looking for secret bases and things. So we didn't do it because we didn't want to spend a night in jail or get fined. However, we did meet two Indian guys in a parking lot and got chatting to them. And there was Dulce's sort of surround. It's a sort of valley area, but surrounded by really spectacular mountains and the big mesa, which is just colossal. And for someone who, you know, lives in London, England, this was really a spectacular place to be. And we've met these two Indian guys, sadly, clearly alcoholic, as seems to be the case on a lot of reservations. And one of them I got chatting to, and he said, "Oh, do you want to see some Native American magic?" And I said, "Of course I do, sure." So he kind of waved his arms around and sort of pointed his hands at a big cloud, and sure enough, there was a lightning strike, you know, swiftly afterwards. And then he kind of winked at me and laughed and said, "Oh, don't tell anyone." But of course I have told lots of people about it. I think there are many different ways to cut that moment up and examine it. But it was a fantastic, moment of, you know, true magic, I think, and of real magic. And I hope from moments like that, you can sort of, in the book, the book's dotted with dreams and sort of little incidents like that, that I hope kind of reflect the bigger UFO picture in some way and the sort of message of the book. UFOs are a kind of perfect fusion of sort of magic and technology. I think that's, you know.
I also think it's funny. We have a recurring guest and a friend of mine, Teokas and Ghost Horse, who's a Lakota activist. And he's willing to talk about UFOs and stuff like that with us.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the audacious statement, you know, Native Americans don't get abducted. You know, like this is a white guy phenomena, which it may just be. But, I mean, the implication there is that they have a different relationship with whatever this thing is that just completely goes ignored or is treated as mythology. But as we all know, so do the rain dances, so does everything else. And here you've got a guy who conjures up a storm before your very eyes, and it just sort of is there, but it's glossed over. It just strikes me that, like, geez, maybe we should be talking to these guys a little bit more, you know? Maybe they have quite a bit to offer in the realm of UFOs and magic and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's one of the sort of amazing things about the UFO story, and infuriatingly, I sort of came across this document. It was actually sent my way by Nick Redfern after the book came out, but it's a sort of important sort of missing link, I think, in the book that if I was to revise it, I would sort of include. But it's a 1950 paper put out by RAND, the US Air Force's Research and Development kind of wing, and it's about the exploitation of folklore and superstitions for psychological warfare purposes, which is ultimately, you know, what I'm talking about. I'm presenting the UFO story as a sort of part of that ongoing process. But in the paper written after, so not long after World War II, they talk about the need to kind of analyze the local folklore and superstitions in the environment in which you're working, in the country or in the sort of culture that you're working in. And of course, you know, in our globalized cultural sort of system that we now live in, the UFO has become a kind of omnipresent and sort of monocultural kind of form of technological magic that appears in almost every culture. And, you know, I have a friend who spends a lot of time working in Peru with local indigenous healers and curanderos and shamans and things, and they have their own sort of version of the UFO and alien encounter lore now that's kind of worked its way into their traditions and systems. And I think you'll find this, you know, all over the world, that the UFO has become a universal kind of symbol or icon for magic and for a higher presence, basically for some kind of technological angels or gods who can guide us humans and sort of save us from hopefully from destroying ourselves. And yes, I think it'd be interesting to see to what extent that's sort of worked into Native American cultures. It might be that sort of it's in a sort of syncretic process. This has been these their own traditions and UFO traditions have kind of merged together. I'm sure they will have done at certain points. It's interesting you bring up the abduction question. I mean, one thing that fascinates me is that it's not just Native Americans who aren't being abducted. It doesn't seem like anyone's being abducted anymore. What happened there? Where did, you know, and 10, 15 years ago, everyone was being abducted. And now it just seems to have stopped. I don't know if the aliens abandoned their program or they discovered what they needed to learn from us. Or...
Well, I don't know. In one sense, I think I've witnessed this with people that it's changed. The beings have changed. It's as if, I mean, it is as if, well, this isn't aliens. This, whatever this is, it puts on different masks for different times and it's switching masks. Mm-hmm. So part of me wants to say that's what's going on. The other part wants to say, well, because... You know, all of that hypnotically retrieved little alien doctor stuff was bogus to begin with, and so the story never changed. It never evolved. It never went anywhere, and people got bored with it and so stopped talking about it.
You know, yeah.
Maybe that's it.
And I think I would suggest the answer is, you know, somewhere a fusion of both of those suggestions in that people, you know, the story was bogus, but I think the experiences are not, they're, you know, for some people they are they're genuinely anomalous and hard to explain, and for others they're more conventional forms of sleep paralysis or, you know, confusing dreams for real experiences or, you know, being influenced by popular culture, or in extreme cases going to see hypnotherapists or UFO researchers using hypnosis who actually implant terrifying ideas and memories into their unconsciouses, into their unconscious, which with scary and potentially dangerous implications. So I think it's a good thing that people aren't still being abducted. But it'll be interesting to see if there's a revival of the, maybe in another 5-10 years, there might be a bit of a revival of those ideas. Although, having said that, there's never been much of a revival of sort of the contactee encounters of the 1950s, which I think are probably more interesting than the sort of abduction story.
Well, I guess I'm going a different way with it, in that I'm thinking if we just continue to say, you know, that mask isn't it. That's not it. I don't know what this is, but that's not it. Mm-hmm. Will the phenomena respond? Will it eventually tilt and reveal itself, or will it change into something so completely different, you know, that it would almost force us to believe, okay, this is real?
Mm. I mean, I ultimately think it's us, but it's parts of us or ways or kind of aspects of us that are always going to remain out of reach or out of sight. And I think the point is that, like I was saying with the UFOs, they always stay a few steps ahead of, you know, what we can do. I think in the same way these the beings or the entities or the presences that people encounter will always remain enigmatic and will always remain just out of reach, and you know, there's the I think, a really important kind of theme that I touch upon a little bit in the book, is this, the whole element of the sort of trickster archetype or motif, who, and that's explored very deeply in an amazing book called The Trickster and the Paranormal by George Hanson.
That he's on the show all the time.
Yeah, he's a great guy. That's a very important book. But, and I think, you know, that the sort of purpose of that trickster, and I think the UFOs themselves are tricksters, is to kind of, you know, push us to stop us from becoming complacent, to keep the sort of drive for novelty alive within, you know, within us and within our cultures. And that's, you know, I think that's a very important role. So I think, for that reason, whatever we want to call them, UFOs, aliens, you know, fairies, angels, demons, whatever, you know, I think these are critically important aspects of our culture and of our personalities.
Well, it's unfortunate that we only have a few minutes left, because I really want to get into your role as a trickster in terms of being a crop circle maker. And John Lundberg, please get the message to him that we would love to have him on the show. I'd love to do crop circles with him.
I'll email him. I mean, I haven't been doing it for, I haven't made, been out in the fields for a few years now. But
I have a question about that, which is, now, Colin Andrews, who we've had on the show, and when we had him on the show, I got to tell you, a lot of high strangeness activity centered around that episode during the show and then in the days that followed.
What kind of things have you got to?
Well, during the show, I mean, it was one of those things where we were really into some deep territory, and all of a sudden, one by one, the computer banks in his place shut down, you know, at the moment that we were all sort of feeling that sense of, you know, that sense of, I don't know what, you know, when you're having that sort of big question discussion and you feel that depth. And then I don't remember exactly what, but Jeff had some odd experiences the next day. One thing was, Jeff had described to him, or didn't describe to him, Jeff told him about a symbol that had appeared on his mirror in some sort of waxy substance that he had jotted down. He hasn't showed anyone, and Colin then sort of faxed over the his impressions as Jeff was talking, and he sort of got the component parts right, you know?
Wow, so it was like a remote. So
yeah, so that was strange. But then here, for me, what was really strange is the next night, I had really bad back problems, and basically when I was waking up in the morning, I had this dream that I was like sort of half awake, and I was like, do I want to see how this plays out, or do I want to wake up? I was like, okay, I'll see how it plays out. Where I'm sitting in this, well, a movie theater, watching a movie, and this sort of, I don't know if he was Native American or Mexican, this giant sort of faceless guy in a hat with long hair, who just, I guess, struck me as some sort of magician, started to walk by me as the movie was ending, and I grabbed onto his shirt or coat and pulled him down and said, I know who you are. I know what you can do. Show me. And he cups my stomach. And in real life, as I'm dreaming this, I feel like this jolt of electricity go through my stomach. And in the dream, I get scared and I go, yeah, that's it. Do it again. Show me again. And he does it again. And he walks away and the dream ends and I wake up and I'm lying in bed and my entire back is completely numb, to where I think, oh shit, am I paralyzed? You know, what is this? After a few minutes, the numbness goes away. I get up and my back is healed. So that's strange. And then, you know, I write to Colin Andrews about this, and it turns out, perhaps related, who knows, Pat Delgado, who had died recently, his old research partner, had developed some sort of healing power while out in a crop circle during this event that he had described, and then I guess took on some sort of Indian, I don't know, shaman mentor or whatever, and so he sort of related it to that was Pat's way of saying, you know, hey, from beyond the grave or something.
Maybe I've met this guy, Ron Bearcloud Berry, I think that might be, who was a crop circle researcher who was became interested in, I think that was his name, that was a long time ago.
So what do you make of stuff like, I mean, if crop circles really are nothing, now...
They're not nothing.
Colin Andrews says that he has spoken to many crop circle makers, and they've all talked about feeling compelled to do it as if by some force. He's also talked about one guy who he and his son were supposed to go out and create a formation. They had planned on it, and then one of them got the flu, but the formation showed up in the field the next day anyway. And they hadn't told anyone that they were going to go make it. And then, of course, we always hear about balls of light being seen and all this sort of stuff. So you, hanging out in those circles, and literally, what do you make of that aspect of it? Is that all wishful thinking, or is there something to it? Have you heard that from your fellows about feeling compelled to do it?
Certainly. That part is less difficult to make sense. I mean, that, it's a compulsive, addictive thing to do. It's quite thrilling. It's exciting. It's fun and satisfying. And like any practice, it can be all consuming and can kind of possess you. Remember that the people who are making the crop formations, and I assure you and your listeners, they are people. They're essentially artists, and artists get obsessed with things, get possessed with ideas or with their work or whatever, and that's really a metaphor for what they're talking about. But on to the other subject of kind of strange things happening, absolutely, not myself, but a lot of the other circle makers I met and spoke to had described genuine, anomalous experiences and lights and flashes and all sorts of sort of weird things going on while they were making circles. The point I would make is that a lot of the people who make crop circles are also genuinely interested in paranormal phenomena and UFOs and parapsychology and, in Fortean matters generally. So a lot of them are kind of already kind of primed or kind of, in the sort of state of mind or consciousness that they're open to weird things happening. So they might, as we were talking about earlier, they might interpret what to some might be mundane instances, they may interpret them as something extra mundane. However, there are certainly many accounts of balls of light, orange and coloured balls of light being seen around that part of the country. And although the phenomenon isn't fully understood, the idea of earth lights or kind of some kind of piezoelectric, electromagnetic or geophysical sort of phenomena creating these sort of balls of light, that's known to happen as a sort of not fully understood natural phenomenon. So it might be that one of the reasons that the landscape where the crop circles are centered on has always been this kind of sacred landscape where you have burial mounds and Silbury Hill and stone circles and all these things. It might be because in some way these phenomena did emerge in these areas, so that's why people were drawn to them. Perhaps that's one possibility, and that's obviously the crop circles are just sort of continuing these traditions, perhaps. As we said earlier, the crop circles are often amazing works of art. But the real magic is not in their creation, which is a matter of geometry and skilled planning and backbreaking, exhausting work. The real magic is in the way people respond to them, the way people, interpret them, and the way people have, as you're saying, really often very unusual experiences around them. And I think that's something, the magic is within us, is something that's kind of generated by us and can be contagious as well, and people can very quickly get kind of absorbed into or drawn into these kind of magical environments or magical social sort of exchanges and cultures. So that's the magic, and crop circles, like UFOs, are kind of engines for generating this kind of magical space and sort of magical reality.
Well, I guess I just have one more question, even though that's the perfect place to end it. If they are all man-made from the 70s onward, why did it take so long for them to develop? I mean, it seems as though they were just a pockmark here, a pockmark there, and then all of a sudden you have these years of evolution.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, that's one of the greatest, in the same way, and again, we could talk about this with UFOs, but we don't have time, but that kind of evolution of their designs and of their capabilities is, you know, to me, one of the ultimate hallmarks for making these out as human phenomena. So in the crop circles you had back in the 70s, you had Doug Bauer and Dave Chorley making very simple circles and then expanding it to include lines and so straight edge elements. Then the sort of next wave picked up the so-called A-Team, and they started, who were, you know, Doug and Dave, remember, were in their 50s when they started. So by the time that the newspapers were taking notice in the late 80s, they were, you know, getting on a bit. And by this time, kids in the area who were, you know, much younger in their teens were doing the kind of really first wave of really spectacular formations. And, you know, from there, the bar was being raised, you know, the sort of bar of complexity was being raised each time. So then the guys, I ended up working with Rob Dickinson and Rob and John Lundberg and others, they came in the early 90s and again pushed it higher and higher. And I'm not sure that the last few years has seen that bar being raised, but I think new groups are emerging and sort of, you know, developing their art, and hopefully, you know, there's going to be a kind of cyclical evolution where every few years you'll get people mastering the art and producing really spectacular and phenomenal and magical formations. But so, yeah, to me, that's really an argument for their being human rather than not being human. And I've never understood why or how people thought this was the best way for another intelligence to be communicating anything with us at all.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Surely there are more direct.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for doing the show. It's been a pleasure, and your book, as I said, is a great read. The book is Mirage Men. Please get out there, buy it, read it. I'm sure you'll love it. And Mark, why don't you tell us again your website where people can read up on your latest?
Sure. I run a Mirage Men website called miragemen.wordpress.com, and that's, I update that maybe every couple of weeks, once a month, with information, and I've kind of tried to expand upon the material in the book. But I also run a small publishing house called Strange Attractor Press, and you can find out information about that at www.strangeattractor.co.uk, and I think your listeners will find plenty there to interest them, including we published The Field Guide by Rob Irving and John Lundberg, which is, amongst other things, a history of the crop circle phenomenon and a very detailed guide about how to make your own. So that might appeal.
Great. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks for staying up.
All right. I'll go to bed now.
Appreciate it. Take care.
Cheers. Bye.
This is Nick Redfern, and you're listening to Paratopia.
Thanks.
And it is amazing we didn't get Jacques Vallée to do that.
So the Jeff.
So the Jer.
Mark Pilkington, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, Mark Pilkington. No relation to Carl Pilkington, I'm guessing. I don't know. I mean, does anyone besides me watch An Idiot Abroad on the Travel Channel?
Nope.
It's quite lovely. Wonderful show.
Well, let's just assume they're not related.
Okay.
And go on with the show. How are you, by the way? You okay?
I'm good.
All right. Just making sure. I got to check up on you every now and then, buddy.
I'm good.
All right. So anything that you want to chime in on? Anything that you heard in the interview that piqued your interest?
Well, I think the last bit about the crop circles was interesting. So correct me if I'm wrong. He's down with the idea that these things are, they're man-made. I mean, he very clearly thinks that, and that there's nothing that isn't man-made about them. But he is not, you know, he doesn't object to the idea of weird things happening while the Circle Makers are there, nor is he objectionable to them being inspired to do this by something else. Am I understanding that correct?
Partly correct. I think the first part is correct, but I think the inspiration part he just attributes to the creative impulse to want to go out and create art in the fields.
Okay.
But at the same time, he does acknowledge balls of light, flashes, and odd things out there.
Well, I noted that he didn't have much of a reply when it came to, say, when you mentioned about the brothers making the crop circle that night, and one came down sick, and it showed up anyway. And, you know, when we had Richard Hall and David Caton and Robert Hulls on the Crop Circle Roundtable way back in episode 47, you know, the one thing that really impressed me about what they had to show us, I believe it was on Richard's site, Richard Hall, was the crop circle that wasn't a flattened circle. It was like grooves of a record, but the stalks were not folded at the ground. They were folded inches off the ground. It looked waist high. I would be very interested as a guy who's made things out of nothing with his hands for years, how one would go about doing that. I found that to be really, really curious. And how you would do that and not, I don't know, have ridiculously gross disturbance. You know, I could easily say, okay, well, if we put a stake in the ground and we take a piece of wire and we run around the edge, it's possible that we could crimp above the ground, like well above, like just say 3 feet above the ground. That's perfectly capable to do something like that. But you would also break a lot of them, and you would have footprints, and you would have a center point as well. Now, how you would do that multiple times at different levels. So remember, that crop circle was literally off the ground and in different levels to look like the grooves of a record. I don't know how anyone's doing that. And for now, I'd have to say I'm not buying that somebody made that with their hands. That just seems way, way, way out of what I think we'd be capable of doing neatly. And that was rather neat. And, you know, the other thing I was kind of sorry that I wasn't there to say was, well, what about, you know, the old wood print that we have from the newspapers way back in the day, showing the mowing devil, which is, what was that, 1800s, 1700s? I don't even remember how old that is.
Yeah, I don't remember.
But, you know, we've got that. And so that very clearly looks to me to be an indication that this phenomena has been going on longer than Doug and Dave.
Or crop circle artwork has been going on longer than Doug and Dave.
Exactly. That's true. Yeah.
I mean, what if it was just one or two people for a long while?
Right.
Until Colin Andrews discovered it and then made it a big media frenzy. Mm-hmm. But there is this other thing that is a legitimate paranormal issue, which is whatever these lights are that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
So what if whatever is out there responded to the attention?
Right.
And however that works, I mean, you know, we assume that when Colin Andrews, Pat Delgado, and whoever it was, BBC, or not BBC, but I guess the Japanese version, or was it BBC? I don't remember. But they go out there and they hear this sound whirring around their heads, and then they see, or they hear it sort of land mm-hmm. in front of them, and then it pulls them towards it, and all of that whole levitation thing.
Right.
We're assuming that has to do with the crop circle, but maybe that just has to do with whatever the phenomena is that's out there that's, you know, inherent to the environment.
Right. That could be, yeah. I don't know. I mean, just not even just based on that singular circle I mentioned that's like a record that's off the ground. I mean, that's curious. Just because you can't explain off the top of your head why it is doesn't mean there isn't an explanation, but I'd really like to see somebody pull that one off. And for right now, I'm kind of throwing that into the unknown category. If anybody out there knows a way that that can happen, I'd really love to hear how that's a possibility.
Well, here's a question. I mean, have all of these crop formations been claimed by the various groups? If not, then you would suspect that the group's answer to that would be, well, some artists want to remain anonymous because it, mm-hmm. you know, it keeps the whole mystique of it going, and sure. it's a great sociological project, blah, blah, blah. But what if that's just their assumption, and what if some of them really are the phenomena?
Well, that's the question, and we don't know. I mean, it reminds me a lot. I mean, what you were saying earlier about the mowing devil thing, and is this something that people have done for a very, very long time? I'm sure a lot of people would poo-poo that answer away, but I can point you to the film done by Religulous. Who what was the man's name?
Bill Maher.
Bill Maher. You know, he went to somewhere over in England where they have a very large man with a very large penis in a club on a hill. And, you know, this thing has been there for God knows how long. And what he remarks is that it's still there because the people now in the area take care of it and mow it and, you know, keep it tidy. And so it's not out of the question that people in general would kind of nudge this thing along throughout history. That's a possibility. We can't rule that out. I don't even... I mean, anymore, you hear about, just for instance, people talk about there are small metal samples that seem to be radioactive, that seem to be magnetic. A lot of people point to that as this is something very, very strange. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, Is that really the line where you have to say that's not something that you would usually happen with a crop circle that is man-made, when later you find out that yes, groups have taken particles of metal and I don't know, microwaved them or whatever the hell they did to them, and then spewed them out throughout a crop circle. Now they're admitting some of them have said they've done that. Does that count for all? What came first, the story of them finding this material on crop circle stalks or them doing it? There's no way to tell. I mean, George Hansen must love this because this is truly his whole thing in action right here. Is, you know, it's going to stay hidden. It's going to be surrounded by all this, you know, this nonsense and subterfuge. It's all over the place. And now it's impossible in my mind to really look at this and say this is man-made or this isn't. The only thing I can say about it is I was in one in Maryland many years ago. The MUFON director for my area had call for I think it was two locations where very strange lays were happening. These were not circles. These were not any kind of design that I could tell. It looked basically like a grape shot, including little spatters. You know, you get a big, like somebody threw a big water balloon, and then you'd get these little spots of overlaid crop. And for years, I had those stalks in the condo. I had them on the wall. Because they were so fascinating, because literally the node within whatever you want to call it, the formation, were bent. They were not broken. They were bent over at a specific height, and they were laid over, and the edge of that stalk was just slightly burned or brown. And I don't know. I mean, the first location I think was around a church, and the second one was on private land, not very far off the road. And when I went with the director to gather samples for inside and control samples outside in graduating distances, I had the very distinct feeling that there was something across the street watching us. And I kept looking, and I didn't see anything. And unbeknownst to me, a man by the name of George Reynolds, who was head of MUFON in the area, I'm not sure if he still is or not. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. He's actually just friended me on Facebook not long ago. He took a picture of me looking across the street. And across the street is a large black smudge in the air. Looks like it's across the street in that field in the air. And he showed that to me at a meeting, and I wanted to get a copy from him. And I, after a while, I ceased going, and I ceased asking him for one. But I don't know what to make of those. But that clearly didn't look like a person did that. Could it have been an agricultural answer to that? Maybe. But those stalks were clearly not messed with a board, pushed over, anything like that. These were – it looked like – a ball of energy had come down out of God knows where, smacked the field and exploded, and just you had gotten that as if it was a water balloon, a gigantic water balloon. You got these spots, these grape shot spatters going out from this thing at a very clear impact point, and then a very clear, an area where slowly but surely the crop started to rise back up. And I'll tell you what's interesting about it. You always hear him say in a crop circle, it's curved one way on top, and then you lift up a layer and it's curved the other way underneath. That's true. I saw that with my own eyes, that regardless of what direction the grape shot had come from, and it was very clear to tell what way it had come from just by looking at the lay. If you were standing in front of the spot where it hit, and you're looking out into this formation and seeing how it trails off, you could reach down in front of you, I shit you not, and put your hand into the fallen crop, the bent crop, and pull on it. And when you pulled it up, it was like it was weaved together like a blanket. And if you peeled that up and put your fingers through and pulled it, you could see the stalks going the opposite direction underneath from what you were holding. And then that underneath of that, again, an opposite direction. I don't know how someone's doing that. And if somebody wants to, again, explain to me how you would lay individual stalks over without bending them, they looked like they had bent at a node and fallen over and then very close to the ground. But they were not bent in that sense. It was like they had grown that way. And clearly they hadn't grown that way. Something had bent them in this direction.
Well, he's got a book now, so on how to make crop circles, so maybe it's in there.
I'd very, very much like to know how you do that.
I wanted to get into with him, mm-hmm. but the conversation just didn't get to go that way. Is the fact that when he was 16, he also saw a UFO or a series of UFOs in Spain. So he saw them at 16. He saw them again at, 22 or, later in life,
okay. I
think age 22. And then he becomes a crop circle maker.
Mm-hmm.
It's just funny to me that he doesn't see a connection. Why is it that these morons all think that crop circles are connected to UFOs when we're out making them.
Right.
And here he himself as a crop circle maker is tied to UFOs.
Right.
So at least on that level, they are, and being a guy who reads George Hansen's work and who does think that this is in some way intricately connected to us.
Right.
You would think that he would see the connection to himself, but it doesn't sound like he does.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe not.
I mean, How many people have seen UFOs twice in their life that dramatically?
Well, yeah, that's not a common occurrence. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, most people go through life and never see one. That's what they say. I'd
throw that out there for him. I'd like to have him back on. I'd love to talk about this with him.
I'd love to be in on it. I mean, it sounds like in many ways he kind of falls along our thoughts on this stuff to a certain degree. I mean, the crop circle thing... I don't know. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm, some kind of ridiculous, defender of this thing. I'm not. I just find certain parts of it that I cannot readily explain that don't seem to make a whole lot of sense. And when you're standing in the middle of it, looking at it and going, I'm just not – how in the world would you ever do that? I mean, and when you stand there and you see the mess that it is, it just almost – you just look at – that's impossible. That's just impossible. And so I know at least the one that the ones that I was in, Linda Moulton Howe had been there, and I know that we were collecting samples that were going to go to Dr. Levengood, I believe. And all I ever heard from that after it was over was that Georgia told me that he found those samples to be very interesting. And that was it. I never heard any more about it. I really didn't go to meetings much after that. So I don't know. I think that there is something strange about some crop formations. I think there is something strange about this is not necessarily saying it's intelligence, but is there some kind of energy that can affect plants and lay them over like that in a grape shot? I'll take that. You know, what would that be? I'd still like to know. I mean, as far as phenomena occurring when guys are out in the field making these things actively, I wonder how far back that goes. I mean, I wonder, did Doug and Dave, you know, did they have that sort of thing happen? Did they know that? Or is that something we're just hearing now? And again, the trickster's in full play there because you've got guys out actively hoaxing circles. And these are the guys that are seeing it. So it's the negativity is already there. The fail-safe is already in. And so do you believe them or do you not? They're already hoaxing things. What's the sense in believing them? That stands to reason that I would tend to think a great many of them are actually seeing something, but we don't know. I think you're right. I think it could be for the reasons that I've said UFO hotspots happen. I think it could be because people go there to see these things. People, a vast amount of energy and thought and planning. So your focus of intent is there, your execution is there. And then people coming there thinking and reacting to these things could be calling, for lack of a better word, whatever weird manifestations there are. I mean, can you ignore the policeman's report Colin told us about where he saw these large, tall people who could run faster than any human he ever saw running from this thing? And then he ends up having poltergeist activity and all sorts of strangeness occurring after that. I mean, can you ignore that and say, yeah, crop circles are, there's nothing to it. There's something to it. But my guess is just like UFOs, it's a hell of a lot deeper and more complex than we can stick a label on for. So I don't know. I think I think we have to do some more shows on that.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's interesting because it seems like his take on it is that either for profit or for religious reasons, you know, people want to stick to this crop circle thing come hell or high water. They want it to be anomalous. And I didn't. I threw it away until I saw Colin Andrews' presentation. And then it was like, no, that's undeniably something. Interestingly, he references that presentation in this book, but he doesn't name Colin Andrews. He doesn't name the crop circle researcher.
Okay.
But he, I believe, if I remember correctly, says he saw that presentation. So I would love to have him back on. I'd love to have John Lundgren on, especially Mr. Crop Circle Maker, or Lundberg, yeah. I'm sorry, John Lundberg. And just ask them about that stuff. I mean, what do you do? What do you do with that? Because, again, I'm not somebody who even wants to believe in crop circles. You know, right. I used to way back when, but when it became clear that they were man-made, it was like, well, this is clearly man-made.
Exactly.
But now it's not clear what that means anymore.
Exactly.
Man-made, but at whose impulse, at whose whim,
well,
and why?
I mean,
and as far as this, you know, not being the best way for aliens to communicate with humans, you know, through crops, well, yeah, obviously. Doesn't fit into that pattern, but it sure fits into a George Hansen type scenario.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, just simply a pay attention to this.
Right.
And we'll amp up activity.
Well, I mean, let's I want to kind of point people to the Psychedelic Salon. There is a episode on there. If you scroll down, some episodes, I'm sure by now on iTunes or at their website, just look up Psychedelic Salon. You'll see on there a trilogue between three men, one of them being Terrence McKenna, one of them being clearly on the fence about crop circles, one clearly, I want to say that he was in that very old group. This is a very, I think, a very old trilogue conversation, but he must have been affiliated with the crop circle research team that was big back in the 80s, late 90s, or late 80s, early 90s. And he was decidedly pro that these were anomalous. And then Terrence was very much against the idea of it being anything anomalous at all. And he said, you know, that hoaxing was probably the most logical explanation for it. And at the time, and I still think this was kind of an ahead of his time way to look at it, he said, you know, I think that likely this is something that the MI5 is involved in. And they are doing this as some kind of test to see what people's reactions will be to the unknown. And he says, and they're getting a hell of a lot of good data out of this as long as this continues. He said, but at some point, someone is going to see something and someone is going to be caught, and then it will all go away. And interestingly enough, when we did that crop circle roundtable with Rich and David and Robert, that's something that they were pretty hard on about was MI5 being involved with some of these makers and putting them up and financing them. Any of that true? I don't know. It was a compelling argument to me at the time. I'd have to go back and listen and look again. But it doesn't seem to be going away, despite the fact that we know humans make these every year. People still go in to see them. And that brings me back to the whole argument that an artist probably has heard in his life at least once, is that there are no original ideas and that every idea that you have comes from somewhere else. And so is that what's going on here, that people are going out and effectively making temporary temples in crop circles that therefore call this phenomena in to observe it? Is that what the tall whites were doing in a crop circle that was there beside the road when the policeman tripped upon them? Is that what was going on? And the answer is we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you can really blow them off, even as anomalous. I mean, certainly not all of them, but I think, is there a possibility that a small, small percentage of them, perhaps spread out over years and not seasons, are anomalous? I would say there's still that question in me that says it's a possibility that there are very, very rare ones, perhaps years apart, that cannot be fully accounted for. So I don't know.
What we really need is for crop circle makers to be out in the field making something and then have some ball of light or something finish it for them.
Yeah, let me give you a hand here.
All right. Well, I got to say, you know, this really is a great book. It's well written, and there's a lot of stuff in there that we didn't cover. I mean, we really just scratched the surface of all of the really good, solid information that's in this book. So please go pick up Mirage Men. I feel like the interview didn't do the book a service in, you know, in terms of fleshing out all of what's in there.
Right.
So that just means we'll have to have him back.
Yeah. Yeah. I would love to have him back on. I mean, what I heard was really interesting, and I'd very much like to have him and maybe a couple crop circle makers on at the same time.
Yeah. How do we get Kit Green on? That's who I really want to have on.
That would be a trick. Hmm. So
you
still,
do you have his phone number?
I'll have to look. I'll have to look. I'm not sure.
Hmm. Well, if Mark or any of his buds happens to listen to this and you have information on how it is one would make such a crop circle as Jeff described, let us know, because we want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you listen to episode 47, I'm pretty sure that the addresses might be in there for that. You know, you can look for Crop Circle, Richard Hall, David Caton, and Robert Hall. So if you look that up, you should come upon Richard Hall's rather elaborate website. And there are films on there, and there are essays, and a lot of photographs. And that formation is on there somewhere. You just have to do a little hunting and pecking and find it. I think that that's a very interesting thing. And like I said, if anybody knows how to do that, I'd love to hear it.
Very good. Our thanks once again to Mark Pilkington. And we'll be talking a little bit more about this and some other things that I'm going to hold off until Paratopia Live this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Are we still at ParaQuestRadio.com?
We are.
Okay.
Well, the banner on our homepage will be linked directly to the page where you can listen.
Okay.
And that seems to have worked well last week. So everybody come on back for number three.
That's right. In number two, we actually broke their record of people listening in on the live chat. So
great.
There you go. Let's break it more. More
That's
breaking.
Right.
Let's break
and
our own
way,
record.
And by the way, let's toot our own horn a little bit more and say that we're number three on Cyber Ears out of all their podcasts. We were number two. But Mountain Stage Podcast has knocked us from our throne at number two, which we held for a week.
Mountain Stage Podcast is actually of a radio station. So
right, yeah.
They've got, like, radio audience.
That's right.
So that's not fair.
It's not fair. But it's the way the game goes.
That's right.
I'm happy to be at number three. I think that's great.
Sure. All right, everybody. Jeff Ritzman, your balls. Have a good night.
Good night.